Today's episode of Socially Democratic is presented to you by Dunn Street. Dunn Street is a progressive campaign agency that specialises in campaigns and community organising. We work with non-profit and community-based organisations, trade unions, progressive businesses and social democratic parties across the globe. Dunn Street develops community engagement and organising strategies to win campaigns both big and small. They train engagement staff, volunteers and organisers in leadership and power building, and we help leaders craft their own narrative that tells a story that can unite people and move them to act together. And if you want to create change in your community, then hit us up at dunstreet.com.au. Today's episode is also brought to you by Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. When you need support with a legal issue, it can feel daunting, and that's why for over 100 years, Maurice Blackburn has been helping guide clients with their legal needs. They're here to help you when you need them the most, from workplace to medical injuries, class actions, occupational diseases, and wills and estates planning. As Australia's leading plaintiff law firm, they have the local knowledge and the national network with the experience that you can count on. To find out more, simply go to their website, which is mauriceblackburn.com.au. After doing how many shows, I can't believe I didn't know how to pronounce Maurice Blackburn. And finally, today's episode is brought to you by SwiftFox. Every moment on a campaign matters. You need the tools that you can trust, lists that are up to date, phone banks that can change minds, emails that drive donations, events that will energize the community both online and offline, and text blasts that distill your message perfectly. SwiftFox CRM is made for campaigners by campaigners. And to find out more, simply visit their website, swiftfoxcrm.com, to win your next campaign. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Socially Democratic, your weekly centre-left politics and organising podcast that drops every Friday, that dives into the progressive campaigns of the day and the people leading them from home and abroad. And we're going to be speaking to someone who's been leading the state of Victoria for 9 years. He was elected Premier in November 2014 and he retired from public office a month or two ago. His name is Daniel Andrews and he's on today's episode to talk about his time in politics. And I'm looking forward to that conversation with the former Premier of Victoria, Daniel Andrews. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcast or Spotify or wherever you get your favorite podcast. And if you like the show, please give us 5 stars on your Apple Podcast app and leave us a review as well on Apple Podcast or on Podchaser. And for all the updates for each episode that drops each week, please follow Dunn Street on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. All right, let's get to today's episode. We're taping this one on a Friday afternoon on the lands of the Wurundjeri people, and joining me in the Socially Democratic studios for the third time is the former ALP Assistant Secretary, former member for Mulgrave from 2002 to 2023, the former leader of the Victorian Parliamentary Labor Party from 2010 to 2023, and the former Premier of Victoria from 2014 to 2023, and now a citizen.
And one that feels very old as you run through all of that.
Daniel Andrews, welcome back to Socially Democratic.
Very good to be back, Stephen.
So, how have you been?
I'm getting asked that a lot, actually. Well, it's been good. I've got nothing to do, but I'm very, very busy. So it's a bit of an adjustment. Lots of stuff around the house and a bit of golf and catching up with a few friends and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, it's been good. It's a pretty big adjustment, though, to go from, just in really practical terms, to go from literally every minute of the day being planned out. And if it wasn't planned out, you were thinking about, you know, the next day's planned out stuff. To suddenly having a lot of free time, which is it's good.
I was thinking about even practical things like, when did you first become a minister?
In 2006.
Yeah. When was the last time you drove a car, given...
Well, there's a bit of urban myth about this. I had a driver for 17 years. He was my driver and part of the family and, you know, really good guy. And... I would still drive myself to play golf, for instance. I was not very big on having white cars dropping me off at the golf club, so I would drive myself.
Yeah.
And every now and then I'd do a bit of, you know, normal stuff, drive to my mum's place or, you know, pick up kids and all that sort of stuff. But, yeah, that's one of a number of different adjustments.
Indeed. And so you've now discovered Uber as well, I'm assuming.
I have. Probably the biggest, it's not so much driving, because I used to drive a bit, even when I had a driver, but I had to go and buy a couple of cars. I hadn't bought a car for a very long time. But, yeah, that's funny. There's lots of different things, lots of different changes. But the biggest thing is, you know, I'm kind of responsible for me and my kids and, you know, no one else. It's me and Kath looking after our little world, as opposed to having a whole series of different obligations and different things you had to do, different responsibilities that are no longer on my plate. They're on someone else's.
And as a former premier, you get like a little office.
Best described as a room.
A room in the old Treasury building.
Treasury, I do.
With the former premiers, do you like wander down to Braxy's office and knock on the door and say, "Do you want to go get a cheeky beer?" Or
he's I've not spent a lot of time in there. They're still setting it up, so it was an old storeroom. So everything that it was storing has been taken out. there's a bit.
Are they sending you a message?
There's a little more. I don't know. There was a little bit of patchwork had to be done because there was a leak in the roof, and then I went and made a number of trips down into the basement in my old office, in number one Treasury place, not old Treasury, down into a secret secondhand furniture store that they're running down there. Store as in store, not a store where you might go and buy things.
Gotcha.
So we've picked out a few, you know, old things out of there, and they've all been moved up. And it's quite close to being set up. So I think that's probably more early 2024. I spend a couple of days a week in there.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah.
I want to first get your reflections on your resignation and retirement from public life first, and then we maybe go back to then do a bit of a kind of chronological conversation.
I'm in your hands.
What was the thing that drove you to decide that you wanted to pull the pin?
Well, as I said on the day, and look, I think we caught a lot of people by surprise. There'd been a lot of speculation, a lot of talk for pretty much from the from polling day last year. You know, how long will he stay? Will he go? All this sort of stuff. But I don't think anybody quite expected that we would make that decision grand final week. But look, as I said on the day, the moment you start thinking about, the moment you sort of your mind starts wandering to thoughts of what it would be like if you weren't doing the job, then, you know, you owe it, and this sounds very cliched and a bit like it's a line. It's not. It's just true. You owe it to the people that you love, to your family who give a lot. And there's lots of privileges. There's lots of fantastic experiences. But I think it's fair to say politics in the last 5 years is very different to any other time in our history. Mm. So there's been some nasty stuff as well. So they give a lot over a long period of time. And look, people need to remember, like, my kids don't know anything different. Like, Noah was born in the July, in the August, in the August 2002. We moved into the house in the July, and I was elected in the October, November, so the end of that year. So that's all they've ever known, is Dad doing this sort of stuff. And there's been different roles along the way, but it's public life has been, you know, what we've done for the last 20 plus years. So you owe it to them. I think you owe it to your colleagues. You owe it to the people that you serve, and you owe it to yourself that if you're starting to think about other things, you never want, as I said on the day, you never want to get to a position where you resent that role, that job. And I was a long way from that. But I was never going to get into a situation where I wasn't enjoying it and I was in some way resentful of the fact that I had all these different duties to perform and different responsibilities. So it was the right time, and it sounds really odd, but when you know, you know. When it's time, it's time, and you say, okay, we get to do something that very, very few people in politics get to do. Go at a time of your own choosing. Mm. Go when they're asking you to stay. It's highly preferable than the alternative.
I assume you discussed this with your wife, Kath, but did you extend that kind of conversation out to your kids as well? I mean, they're young adults now as well, and they've obviously, you said, they've been a part of this journey with you.
Well, Kath and I had been talking about it for a few weeks in the lead up to that time, and but not for a long time beforehand. And, you know, we brought the kids into the picture a little bit closer to that time. Grace was away. Grace was in overseas in Japan at the time. So she wasn't there for the announcement, which she was a bit upset about. But yeah, look, when you know, you know. And to catch people by surprise is one thing. Like, I don't think anyone picked it. But at the same time, you know, doors open, doors close, all those sorts of things. And you know, it's a great team, and they've got a big agenda. And this was never, despite what people write and what some people think, this is never anything other than a big team of people who all work very hard. And, you know, there's a captain of the team, sure, but and my name's on the front door, but this is a really comprehensive and thoughtful and passionate and hard-working group of people that's colleagues as well as staff, and they all march on to continue doing the important work.
They do. Let's talk about when this important work first began, and I want to go back to 2010, when Labor lost, Victorian Labor, under the leadership of John Brumby, lost the election, which really surprised everyone. I think it surprised people within the party. I think it surprised journalists. I think it surprised the Liberals who were then elected to government.
Did you see it coming? I don't think there's any doubt that the people who became the government were very surprised by the fact that they'd won. I don't think they thought that they were going to quite win as many seats as they did. I had sort of, and I was not pleased about this at all, but I had these lingering doubts as I'd be moving around my electorate talking to people, and certainly on the day, I was handing out at the same booth I'd handed out at for years and years, about federal and state, and I had that many people coming up to me, look, I'll do it one more time, you know, for you, you know, stuff like that. Like, yep. Loyalists, people who were pretty solidly ours, who were, like, they were not pleased. You know, and the thing is, it's just, it's time as well as, you know, a whole range of different challenges that we faced at that time. You know, I've spoken before, and it's not a criticism. I was part of that government, so any commentary is on me as much as it's on anybody else. Like, I was a senior member of that government.
Sure.
But we kind of lost our way a little bit, and we didn't keep pace with growth. And that's not on JB. Like, that doesn't happen in a year or two or 3 years. That happens over the entirety of your journey. Like, we were in power for 11 years. And if you get to the end of that period where you haven't built, you've built lots, but you haven't built enough, where you've done lots, but not enough, then that's on all of us, all of us. And look, wheels turn and, you know, all that sort of stuff, every cliche under the sun. But I had a nagging sense of doubt. I was a little bit concerned. I wasn't the only one. But the other thing too is, you can pick up on a mood, you can pick up that there's a swing on, that you're going to lose seats. But did I think we were going to lose whatever it was, 11, 12 seats, and then finish up losing? I wouldn't say I picked it, but it was soft.
There's a vibe.
Yeah, there was, yeah. And it was a very unpleasant evening.
Okay.
To sit at the ABC telecast from when polls closed till, I don't know, close to midnight, so 6 hours in there, with three mobile phones going at the time, and, you know, lots of numbers that were not good.
Yeah, I can imagine doing
it was very, very
the TV telecast. It's high risk, high reward, because if it's not a great night, it's a long night. But if it's a great night, it's wild.
Yeah, and everyone, look, everyone thinks that everyone wants to be on the broadcast. Not really. Like, you kind of get told, righto, each network wants someone. You should go here. You should, you know, someone else should go there. And, you know, I wasn't lobbying to do it, but I did it, and it was a bloody long night, and it didn't end well. Although it didn't end that night, we had Bentley, which was outstanding by a handful of votes, and a couple of other seats that were close, but that was the one that was always going to be the difference.
Yeah.
And look, to be honest, everyone focuses on the fact that we lost, and that's, you know, makes sense. But the narrowness of the loss was not unimportant over the next four years.
Indeed. Let's talk about those next 4 years, starting with you deciding to put your hand up for the leadership when a lot of people thought, oh, this is just going to go to the right faction within the caucus. Why did you put your hand up?
Well, I don't know that I necessarily put my hand up. I think I had, you know, I had people come to me and say, oh, you're going to have to do this. And there was debate and discussion about whether, you know, I'd be the deputy or the leader. And then the right couldn't agree on who they would support. They seemed to be able to agree on who they wouldn't. Which then meant, well, you know, oh, you'll have to do it. And I've been around long enough to know that I think that many people were able to come to that position because they were certain in their own minds that, well, whoever got the job would be there for a period of time, and you know, they wouldn't do very well, and they would be probably lopped, shall we say, pruned.
Yeah, a transition leader.
You'd be a transition leader, and you'd get shot, you know. 6 months out or a year out or something. Or if it were going really badly, they'd let you eat the loss in 2014 and then get rid of you, you know, not long thereafter. So I was fully aware that history was not with us, and that whilst there were some enthusiastic supporters in the caucus, there were others who, well, better he does that than me. You
know? So courageous.
Well, yeah. Well, look, when you're called to do a job, you do the job. And and look, the other thing too is people forget my seat was very, very marginal. So at one point, it was kind of we win or I won't be there. Like, I was trying to remember when the redistribution cycle, I think it was during that term. So when we ran it, when we ran in 14... it was either win your seat or, win the election or you may not win your seat. So which was fine by me, because if we didn't win, I didn't want to really necessarily be there again for another 4 years.
Yeah.
Certainly, look, how you come to these jobs is not unimportant. The closest to the parliament was really turned out to be really, really important. I went into election night in 2010 just wanting to be the health minister in a fourth-term Labor government. Things turned out differently. I'm not so self-important or sort of lack self-awareness sufficient that I think that I was called because of my innate skills and qualities. I think it was, who's going to do this job? It's a shit job. Who shall we get to do it? And people could coalesce around me because they were opposed to others. Basically. But then once you get the prize, and it is a great honour and a privilege to lead your party, particularly Australia's oldest political party, the most progressive wing, division, branch of our party, the Victorian Parliamentary Labor Party. It's a great honour. But it's not so much having become the leader as what we determined to do with it very early on that I think made the difference.
So you get your feet under the desk and you start to settle in. You're now experiencing life from opposition. What, if you think back now and reflect on the foundations that the team built, what were those strong foundations that led to putting Labor in a chance of winning in 2014?
Well, I think there's a couple of points. One, we had a very, very experienced front bench. We had lost seats, obviously, to lose. But it was a very tight parliament. A lot of the senior team, people who'd been very senior ministers, knew government, knew how the public service worked, knew how the parliament worked. All of those people absolutely signed up to continuing to work hard. So it was a crack team in many ways, up against a bunch of people who, I won't say that it wasn't an accident, like they won fair and square and they ran a really good campaign, a really, really good campaign. But I think they were at least as surprised as some of our people were. To find themselves on the Treasury benches. I don't think they did themselves any favours. Like, they took ages to appoint staff. They were not a unified team, at least from our vantage point. And we were absolutely ruthless. We knew that if you didn't run to win in 14, that you would go backwards. And history has you losing more seats and the government finishing up off a close result in the first election then having a much more workable majority, and you're out for a decade or you're out for more. So we knew you had to go hard and you had to be brutal and you had to really, really focus on winning. Not this, you know, oh, we're here to hold the government to account. Well, yes, you are, but we're here to win. We're here to replace you. We are better than you. We have a bigger vision than you. We've got a better plan than you. We are going to do you. And that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. And if you don't have that sort of self-belief and that sense of clarity about what your role is, it's not to observe someone else govern the state. It's to win the prize and you do the work because, you know, we've got a better and bigger and bolder vision. And it turned out that we wanted it for the right reasons. We'd shown that if we were given it, we would work hard, and Victorians gave it to us.
Talking to social democratic parties overseas that are in opposition or trying to get back into government, I've tried to give them the advice, don't govern from opposition. And I think that's something that your team in that 2010 to 2014 period did well. What do I mean by that? What do you think we mean by that when we say don't govern from opposition? And what did you do in a way that...
Well, you're not the government. Like you, there are certain things where there's bipartisanship is best, you know, issues of social cohesion, issues of, you know, you'd hope things like law and order and other things that are just givens. All too often they don't become the subject of bipartisan support. They're kind of weaponized in pretty obvious terms. But you are not the government. It's not your job to run the place. Like, you shouldn't try and run the place into the ground either. Like, that doesn't serve you well. Like, if you put yourself... I've had this conversation with you before. If you put yourself first, if you act in your own self-interest against the interests of the people you hope to govern and whose support you'll ultimately rely upon, then people work that out. Like, they spot that. And they work out that you want it for you, not for them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, you do see this a lot. People who are so desperate to be close to what they might regard as a proper job, actually being a minister governing, that they almost pretend that that's their role from the other side of the house. No, that's not your role. Your role is to come up with, to scrutinise and to come up with your own plans. You are not the government. It's for the government to govern, and it's for you to unseat the government. And the only way to do that is through hard work, brutally hard work, and good ideas, which are not the same as good policy. So good ideas that where people simply they're founded in logic, they make sense, but you don't, they're not a hard sell. Like, they're not hundreds and hundreds of pages thick. They're about practical, tangible, meaningful solutions to problems that define people's daily lives. And we were lucky enough, you know, whether it's level crossings or other transport infrastructure, new hospitals, nurse-to-patient ratios, all of that and so much more, we were able to come up with not just good policy but good ideas, and then got out and worked really hard to sell it. TAFE, for instance, you know, making sure that every Victorian had the skills they need for the job they want, not decimating TAFE but actually building it up and making it an equal partner so that every young person and every person can make a legitimate choice between a university pathway or a competency-based learning, a TAFE-based pathway. So all of those things and many more. And we did work hard. We worked very, very hard. And that kind of set the tone for once we won as well.
On election night 2014, you said in your speech, the people of Victoria have given us the greatest of gifts, entrusted to us the greatest of responsibilities, and bestowed upon us the greatest of honours. And ladies and gentlemen, we will not let them down. How did you seek to live up to that promise in that first term? What did you do to get that work going?
Well, probably a couple of points. Firstly, it was apparent to me and to us that there needed to be a culture of absolute urgency. Like, there, when we say never waste a day, never waste a moment, like, it's just true. Even if you're in power for a long time, in the scheme of things, in the sweep of history, it's actually not a long time. So you have to work hard every day, and you have to you have to push people and build a culture of urgency, a culture of getting things done. Otherwise, you know, years vanish. Certainly months vanish. And you haven't done much. You've kind of admired problems. You've become what you oppose. You've become, in this instance, you could well become what you've just unseated. So I was very keen to make sure that didn't happen. And that meant, you know, some changes in the public service. And there was a very clear message to the public service. You are there to implement our agenda, because that's what Victorians have voted for. And I got to tell you, this nonsense about it, the independence of the public servants. Yeah, of course, frank and fearless advice. But I had my senior public servant at the very first meeting, literally we'd only just been sworn in, tell me, oh, no, you're going to have to build the East-West Link. And I said, well, no, I'm not. I've just had millions of people vote to not do that and instead voted for our alternative plan. And that's what I'll be building, thank you very, very much. Oh, no, no. It kept going on and on and on. So if that's frank and fearless, well, I think Victorians trump that. I think Victorians beat that out. I think Victorians' voice should be heard, and it's the government's agenda that you deliver, not what an unelected, largely unaccountable public servant thinks you should do. There's a point of balance here, though. You want the best advice, and we've always prided ourselves. I think we have one of, if not the best, public service anywhere, filled with passionate people, hardworking people, brilliant people in many, many ways. But it's the government's job to determine what the priorities are, and it's the government's job to get on and actually deliver. So we didn't build the East West Link because we said we wouldn't, and it was a dog. And if we'd done that, we would have been in this glorious position where all the things we said we'd do and that Victorians had voted for, we would not have been able to do. And the very thing that we'd said we would not proceed with, we would have made our flagship. How do we reckon that would have worked out? I don't think that would have worked out very well at all. Not just for me and us, but for the state. So, you know, that culture of urgency was very important. And I make no apology for being very clear with public servants and others that these are the things Victorians have voted for and these are the things we will do. And we're not entering into a debate about that, because if they're good enough to promise, they're good enough to get on with.
When you get elected,
unless there's a, you know, huge change in circumstance, and then it's not for the bureaucrats to say, well, we've got new priorities. It's for the political leadership to stand up with the courage to explain why.
I was going to ask you these questions later on, but let's go there now and talk, because just check my notes here. The outgoing IBAC commissioner was critical of the government and called on the powers of IBAC to be overhauled. They said the threshold to begin an investigation is too onerous. In addition to that, there's also been this commentary that, to the point before about the politicisation of the public service. Mm. I think The Age ran like a triple page spread in which they were naming and shaming, you know, former Labor staffers that now are working in the public service. It seems like there's this...
Shame on them.
Yeah.
You know, that they might be interested in public policy, they might be interested in... There's plenty of people that have got Liberal Party tickets, or at least used to, that are playing senior roles. I know them well, I respect them, I appointed them. So, you know, is it such a bolt from the blue that people who are involved in politics might also be involved in public policy, might know and understand and be committed to serving others? Like, public service takes many different forms, and the notion that someone has got political beliefs or used to work for a politician at some point in time means that they're forever prohibited from working for all of us doesn't make any sense. But again, people are entitled to have different views about that. But to attribute bad motives just blindly, and to be, oh, well, of course, if you've got any connections with one side or other of politics, you couldn't possibly do a good job. It just doesn't make any sense. I don't know why people see the world in those terms. But look, there's not an accountability officer that doesn't want more money, more power. That's fine. That's their job. The fact of the matter is, though, that all of those agencies have bigger budgets today than they've ever had, more powers than they've ever had. They have opinions and views, and they're more than entitled to those. But I'll tell you what they're not entitled to be. They're not entitled to pretend that anyone voted for them. Not entitled to pretend that they've somehow got a mandate that is equal to, let alone superior to, the duly elected government. But they've got a job to do, and they should be properly resourced. They have been. They should have the powers they need. It's for the parliament to judge what powers they should have. And, you know, issues of hearings and thresholds and all of those things. And those things have changed over time. But it's for the government to say yes or no to those things, and then ultimately the parliament. And we have to, unlike others, we have to defend the decisions we make. Mm.
Let's take a quick break to talk about SwiftVox. Every moment on a campaign matters. You need the tools that you can trust. Lists that are up to date, absolutely. Phone banks that can change minds. Emails that drive donations and events that will energise the community online and offline. And text blasts that distill your message perfectly. SwiftVox CRM is made for campaigners by campaigners. And to find out more, go to SwiftVoxCRM.com to win your next campaign. Okay, let's get back to the show. I'm interested to get a thought, understand your thought process of when you get into government. So we're still in 2014. How do you plan out the next 4 years? Like, how do you strategically think about that in terms of, okay, we've got a shitload of things we've promised to do. We need to get cracking on that. So you talked about this urgency, but you've also got 4 years, right? So what? How do you use that time wisely?
Yeah, being busy and getting things done are two very different things. So you can be frantic. Like, you could be... You can say yes to every invite. You can attend every function. You can go. You can be at every meeting. You can be everywhere and get precisely nothing done. So you have to. It's a bit like golf. You've got to play the hole backwards. So where do I want to be at the end, and then work your way backwards? How do I get to that place? So you have to know. Okay, if it all went well, this is where we would be. This is what we'd have to show for our efforts. These are the things we would have achieved. These are the things we would have. Challenges we would have dealt with, all of that, at the end. And then you work your way backwards from there. Otherwise, you just finish up, it sort of swamps you. Like, you finish up so busy and so frantic that you finish up at the end of a year exhausted, and then you reflect, what have I actually done this year? And you haven't done much. Yeah. So planning is incredibly important. But the plan has to be written from the end point back to where you are now, not the other way around.
Yep.
You've got to know where you want to be. What does success look like? What is the to plan your journey? You have to know where you're going. Mm. And if the ultimate destination is unclear to you, then you get lost very easily.
Mm. In the rough.
Well, more than the rough. Yeah, you're in the woods. You're in real trouble.
You mentioned before about population growth. And the Victorian was it the Victorian economy or the population itself was growing quicker than what you're managing to do when you're in government in the Brax Brumby years?
Yeah, well, there was.
I'm interested to get a sense of the lessons from that to then set up your jobs infrastructure kind of work.
I think there'd be different views on that. There's certainly a narrative that has developed that we didn't keep pace with growth. You know, I think every government struggles to keep pace with growth. Like,
do you mean population growth?
Yeah. So, you know, place got bigger and bigger and bigger. Strain on services. You know, we had a long, protracted, very difficult drought. We had terrible fire events. You know, there was a lot going on. It was not, again, there's never a simple time. There's never an easy time. There's always things that are happening. But all I'm saying is not everyone would necessarily agree with that thesis.
Sure.
But if you accept that for a moment, then what did that mean for us? Well, it meant that, you know, we were not governing from opposition. We had a jobs plan, we had a skills plan. We went and ran hundreds of forums, listening to people, inviting people into our policy process and saying, well, you know, and then it's no surprise that people support policy that they've helped to write. Like, it just makes sense.
Yeah.
And then once we won and we knew where we had to be at the end of the four-year term, so in 2018, we needed to be not like the government we had replaced, who had built precisely nothing. Like, I was just crossing the road coming to see you today. The CEO of the Iron Ear Hospital grabs me at the lights and says, g'day. They've just got their occupancy permit today, like today. This was the only health project that the government we replaced actually started. That's in 2010, 2011. It's just been finished now by us, by the way. So we were very clear that we could not become what we had just beaten. We had to be something very, very different. Mm. And there had to be that urgency and that sense of achievement. We had to get things done. The other thing too is, you know, it's not just about politics. It's about the economics of this. Like, if the government's having a go, that sends the clearest message to the private sector to invest, to take risks, that things are happening here, that this is a great place to be, that there is a sense of urgency. There's a program. Things are happening. You create momentum. You create your own weather almost, you know. The other thing too is that the government doesn't create every job, but the government can underpin demand. The government can play its part in the strength of the state. So for every good reason, not just, well, we want to be in government and we want to win. No one wants to lose. But beyond that, for every good reason, having a go matters. Actually getting things done matters. Getting shit done matters. Mm. And that was our culture, that was our practice. And you know, our first 100 days document has set up a decade or more in office. Literally, those first 100 days and our clarity, those decisions, for instance, providing the $300 million to Plan Metro, when I was told by newspaper editors and others, oh, that'll never get built, and you're cooked in 2018, you've cancelled East-West and you won't have Metro Tunnel started, that's all a pipe dream, you're gone. Well, it's opening.
Mm. Ahead of schedule.
I'll leave it to the government to announce when it's opening, but it's early. Yeah. It's a year ahead of schedule. It's going to transform the city and therefore the state. And the genesis of that, the beginning of that, is those first 100 days and that sense of urgency. And JA and others can be very, very proud, very proud. And as millions and millions of Victorians travel on that, once it's open, they will be blown away, I think, at just what's been built underground there. It's huge.
I was get invited onto Mornings with Raf on ABC Radio here in Melbourne. Hi, Raf. Thanks for having me on. Every couple of weeks. Don't know why they keep having me back, but I was on with Sharnel Vella from Channel 7 a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about infrastructure. And Raf asked me, can the government deliver on all of these projects that are coming up? And I said, yeah. And they kind of laughed at me, going, are you pretty sure of yourself? So I'm going to put the question to you. Can the government do that? Like, there was a view there that where are they going to get the workers from? And I kind of said, well, can't we just give the government the benefit of the doubt because they've already done the things that they said they would do in this last 8-9 years that they can continue to do this? What's your thoughts about that?
Well, important work is never easy. And if these projects were easy, they would have been done decades ago and they wouldn't be on the docket now. You know, North East Link, for instance. We've got a ring road with a gap in it. Makes no sense at all, right? That's going to finish up being one of the biggest projects in the state's history, maybe even country's history. You know, it's a massive, massive project. It's not about can it be done. It's, well, what's the alternative? Mm. Like, it has to be done. These things have to be built. Otherwise, as we hurtle along to being Australia's biggest city, our quality of life will be unrecognisable if we don't get on and build the transport infrastructure that we need. And it is road and rail, as well as hospitals, schools, all of that. And the other thing too is that there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of jobs that are absolutely dependent on that civil works program. And none of it's easy. If because it's hard, oh, we'll just abandon that. Well, that's not leadership. Like, that's not leadership at all. The other thing too, like the sort of spin-off of that whole line of thinking, oh, well, it's not 100% popular. Yeah, well, who said that you had to chase that? Like, seriously, if you wait around for everyone to agree on what we should be doing, back to your earlier point about governing or, you know, being busy but not doing very much, or you blink and next thing it's the election and you've had 4 years and you've done nothing, like, the search to be universally popular will mean you get precisely nothing done. And some people say, oh, you know, that's arrogant or that's this or that. No, you're not elected to admire problems, and you're not elected to find reasons not to do things. You're elected to get on and get it done. So, yes, I think the government can deliver on all of that, But it isn't easy though. Well, there are, you know, coming out of COVID, there's all manner of supply chain issues. There's, you know, it's a pretty. I don't like the term full employment economy, but we're not far off that. Like, it's hard to find staff. That's why, imagine where we'd be if we hadn't invested in TAFE the way we have.
Yeah, bingo.
Like, just imagine. Plus, we've got a lot of workers in different sectors, not so much in the infrastructure space, although they work very, very hard. But when you think about, you know, the point I want to make is more about, say, health workers. They're tired, like, they're fatigued. There's still that whole washout of COVID for them. So there's lots of challenges, lots of challenges. And I think probably the better question would be, well, will it be easy for the government to build all of these things? Well, no. No one said it would be. And as I said before, if it was easy, somebody else would have done it.
I have...
Like the government that we replaced, who, like, didn't do much really at all.
Well, I mean, anecdotally, I spoke to someone who was a public servant working in the sort of infrastructure space during the Beaulieu Napthine government, and they were bored out of their brains. They had nothing to do. So when you guys came in, they were like, oh, thank God, we've got something to do now.
There wasn't much done. Yeah. And again, look, you know, the Victorian community passed their judgment on them. I'm not here to, you know, to be hacking into them, but it's not unimportant that we would, because it helped to set us up, not just to win, but it set up the type of government that we would be, and we still are, under different leadership and different circumstances. But that sense of, you know, we don't want to get to the end of this term, however long it is, and not have done stuff, like, that's the definition of failure.
I in the lead up to this episode, I asked some of your former staff to give me some reflections on your government, because I often think that everyone has an opinion about the Andrews government, particularly media and commentators, but the staff never get to share their voices, and nor can they, because they're staff, right? And that's the role, but they don't work there anymore. So I've asked them to attribute some reflections, not to turn this into Daniel Andrews, this is your life. That is not going to happen here. But I've got a couple as we go through the episode. This first one says, Daniel is an absolute prick. No, don't say that at all. It's about education.
Yep.
Daniel had a deep and abiding commitment to making the lives of special school students and their parents better in every way he could. And it was born out of a policy offering that he put forward a number of years ago, but also, interestingly, how we interacted with the students and their families. And our policy was designed through Daniel's engagement with a number of special school families across multiple roundtables. And parents remarked that the Premier came to the school, but amazingly, he kept coming back and listening to our ideas. And not only that, would he do the roundtables, he would also arrange for the parents to sort of have these fantastic experiences. He talked about the Springvale Park parents all went to the grand final one year. And there was a special school in Bendigo that where there was a young child who had autism, who was obsessed with Lewis Hamilton. So you made sure that they got access to pit lane walks and got a seat at the GP every year. For a dictator, you have an odd interest in listening to people.
Oh, you shouldn't have favourites, but that area of policy I remember goes right back to, I don't know whether I've shared this with you before, but it goes right back to 2003. So I've just been elected, only a few months in the job, and about a kilometre out the back of my office my old office in now Eden Foster's office after a fantastic victory in the by-election last Saturday.
Mazel tov.
Fantastic. Fantastic victory. She's going to be terrific. Really, really good person. Lives her values. Great story. Great local. She'll be a really fantastic local voice. But just behind the office used to be the Noble Park Special Development School. And I was invited down to say hello. And it was all portables pretty much. There was one permanent building. They had to do recess and lunch in shifts. It was terrible. It was really bad. So really early on, they got in my ear and I had no sense. I was like 30 years old. I had no sense of how that part of our education system worked and that there was such a need for improvement. So I kind of became a project. And you know, you win. And why do you fight hard? Why do you do all the things you have to do to win? All the sacrifices, all the stuff you miss in your own family, all the you know, the stuff that's not necessarily enjoyable, well, you do it so that when you get an opportunity to make a difference, you can. I think we've got 87 of those schools. Very soon, the last of those will be upgraded. Every single one of them has been upgraded. And I'm very, very proud of that. And when it comes to services, so not just the bricks and mortar, although that's pretty important, we sat down with parents on numerous occasions over many years, and we'd sit and go to visit the schools, no media or anything, just, you know, in the evening, do a round table, sit down, just listen, you know, what are the problems, what could be better, if you got one thing you could change, what would it be, all that sort of stuff. I'll never forget, we invited, must have been 20, 25 parents who we'd done round tables at the schools with, multiple schools. We invited them into the Melbourne room, which is the big long room that runs across the front of level one Treasury Place, and just next door to the cabinet room. And they all took this, a great big cricket pitch table, and they all took their seats, and there was a piece of paper in front of them, and it had like 20 ideas on it, and there was a pencil for each of them. And I opened the meeting up and I said, just can you give me your top three? You mark the three of the 20 that you want. These are the 20 ideas we've all talked about. I haven't got unlimited money, we can only do three. So they marked up the three and we collated those, and that became the policy that year. And the sense of, they couldn't quite believe that somebody was listening to them. But and I wasn't doing it for the, you know, there's no votes in this. It's not like it's, you know, because we didn't turn it into some sort of docu-series where we had, you know, fly-on-the-wall cameras filming it all. It was like these kids are worth it and their parents are worth it and they've never got the attention that they should get, and we're going to change that. So we did. And it's not perfect. There's still a lot more to do. And, in fact, at our campaign launch in 2022, half the speech was devoted to the latest version of that plan that, it, again, had come from sitting and listening. There's a lot to be said. Like, that's how you gather up wisdom, is by sitting and listening to people. And, you know, look, I locked people in their homes for 2 years. I know that. And I know that, you know, dictator and all this sort of stuff, that's all fine. And if that makes people feel better by describing me in those terms, look, good luck. You know, in Victoria, the haters hate and the rest vote Labor. And that's fine by me. So call me whatever you want. But what really matters is not that nonsense, that noise, that vitriol, that after dark bullshit, and that's all that it is, the worst of American politics imported into ours. What really matters and what makes up for all the nonsense is when you sit with families like that and you listen and you say, righto, that's the plan, we're going to get on and do it. And then you do, and you can see the difference. You absolutely can see the difference.
I think we've got the name of our podcast episode this week. the haters hate and the rest vote Labor. I love it. Put that on a T-shirt.
The other example, and it was funny, you know, I kind of knew a few days before, like, you don't wake up one morning and decide I'm going to resign today. Like, so you've got an idea in your mind a few days before. And me and a couple of senior staff, I don't know whether they're part of your anonymous survey there, we went down to the Metro Tunnel and we did film that, not with journos. We filmed it and put it on Facebook. And I think it was put up the morning of or the day before I went. And we stopped at every station. We're hurtling along under the city on this brand new train built here by Victorians, for Victorians. Hurtling along at 80 kilometres an hour underneath the city through this tunnel that, you know, as I said before, when people get to see it, they're just going to be, it's going to be quite an amazing thing. I turned, as we sort of approached almost the last station, I turned to these two staffers and I said, this is unreal. This makes up for every shitty press conference, every, you know, every tough day, every difficult thing. This is really cool, because it wouldn't have happened. Mm. But it's not on us. It's all the tradies, the workers, the architects, the engineers. You know, they've done an amazing job, and it was great to be able to get off at each of the stations, walk around the platform, shake hands, thank people, tell them how proud we are of them. They're amazing.
It's an engineering feat.
Yeah,
Lee, you started to touch on leadership there, and I just want to get your reflections now that you've had a little bit of time to there's a bit of gap between finishing the job and being a citizen. You know, people in the media were kind of obsessed about this. Oh, he's a very divisive character, Dan Andrews. How do you reflect on the appraisal of your leadership? What does leadership mean to you? I know I've asked this question before, but I kind of want to get a sense now of...
Look, I wouldn't want to give the impression to any of your listeners that I, you know, spend a lot of time thinking about those things. Like, some of the, for instance, people ask me on the day, oh, what's your legacy? What's your, you know, proudest achievement? And I said, well, that's for this. Well, politics is about subjecting yourself to the judgment of others. And people who are obsessed with legacy don't tend to build one because they're just obsessed with, you know, with the words and pondering things and all of that. It's the doing that's most important. I think that there are some Victorians who have never been big fans of mine, never been big fans of Labor, who, because of the quite extraordinary things that we had to do during a 1-in-100-year, highly contagious pandemic event with no vaccine, they're emboldened. Their voices got louder. And that's fine. People are allowed to have views. How they express them is, you know, probably... You know, there's been some nasty stuff, some ugly stuff, but that's life. Polarising, divisive, you know, well, scoreboard, 47 seats, 55 seats, 56 seats. Never been done before. So, you know, I leave the opinions to these people who don't build anything for a living, they don't actually do anything for a living, they just commentate. And they're not unimportant, but spare me, please. You know, it's like, oh, he won't come on our program. It's so disrespectful to our audience. No, I tell you what's disrespectful. When you, moments after the election has been won, you're essentially telling the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Victorians who voted Labor, millions, that they were wrong and that the choice they made is a bunch of bozos. Well, no. Like we have an election. We have a winner. And people who are commentators ought be at least, if not respectful of the people who've won, at least be respectful of the office and the process. Again, you know, telling people they got it wrong is hardly, you know, the most respectful thing. But, look, people will describe you as they see fit. You can't change that. You can't shape that. All you can do is just be focused on the facts. And the facts are, we got a lot of stuff done. We made a lot of difficult decisions. We weren't about being popular. We're about doing what's right. And part of our brilliant democracy is people are allowed to have views on that. They're allowed to have. They're allowed to be divided, and to have lots of different views. I'd much rather have people divided about me than have no opinion, because quite frankly, you occupied the office and you were just this blank space that offended no one and got precisely nothing done. Mm. Like, I don't think that would be serving your oath. I don't think that would be... That would not be repayment to your family for all the events you're not at, for all the distractions, for all the, you know, kind of pretend parenting. And that's what you do. Like, that's no way to thank the people that are closest to you to occupy the office and kind of, you know, oh, but everyone loves me. But that doesn't work either. You've got another question to ask. But I was determined, though. Like, I think the previous government were paralysed by the fact that they were popular for a time, didn't want to do anything, because if you did stuff by definition, some people wouldn't like it. So that means you do nothing. By the end of your time in office, you're deeply unpopular because you've done nothing. So go figure.
Who grounds you? Who keeps you grounded? Who? Do you know what I mean by that? Like what?
Yeah.
Like being a politician, you drive around a car all the time. It's chauffeur driven. You're the leader of the state. You're on TV all the time. You know, you can get a little bit carried away with yourself, right? So what actually keeps you your feet on the ground?
Well, I don't want to sort of speak against the point I'm about to make. No one is so self-aware that they can be absolutely certain that they're not getting carried away with themselves, right? At the same time, though, that's not who I am. Like, you just get on with it. Just get on with the work, and you're too busy to be too kind of caught up in all of that. But for me, the way it presented was not that I'd be getting carried away with, well, you know, self-important or anything like that. Although very few people who are self-important would know it. But so I'll just put that caveat there. But so I'm told, the way it presented for me was not that I would be carried away with my own importance, but that I would go into these kind of deep dives of concern and worry about an issue, and I'd get a bit too focused, a bit too sort of singular with things, and to the exclusion of all others, and, you know, you're just a bit too intense.
Yeah.
So to the point of being grounded is not just about not being, you know, up your own, you know, but it's also about having some balance in your life.
Yeah.
So Kath and the kids, and the thing about three teenagers is that, like, you're never in any doubt. They make sure you know and understand exactly.
Are they brutal?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in a loving way, in a beautiful way, but yep. they're brutal. Kath is not brutal. Kath's very clear though. Like, stop worrying about that. You can't change that. That's done. Move on, and then you move on. But there's no fear of getting carried away with yourself when you live in a household like I live in. And I'll just make this point. I've always lived in my electorate. It's a point of pride. My neighbours are, they were my constituents. And that matters. It means you're getting feedback all the time, all the time. And it's good. It does keep you grounded. Does keep you, you know, you go down the shops and sort of pre-COVID, before we had a whole lot of security stuff and the dynamic changed a bit. But, you know, I'd go and do the grocery shopping and you'd get a few wise words, a few sage opinions, positive and negative, but it was good.
When the government decided to walk away from hosting the Commonwealth Games, in the press conference, I think it was anyway, you said, this isn't even in the top 10 of the hardest decisions I've had to make. No. And I think that then sent the media down a rabbit hole for about 3 or 4 days, which is quite funny in itself. My question is...
What a shock that is.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, the thing's costing an enormously, a much larger amount of money, a much bigger amount of money, and you just can't justify it. So you make the difficult decision. Do I wish it cost less? Yeah, of course. Would have been good to be able to have it, you know. But when you're confronted, like, again, you're not here to do the easy stuff. You're here to do the difficult things. And if the thing's going to cost, I don't know, $6-7 billion, what, and we haven't got it unless you start taking it out of schools and hospitals, no, we're not doing that. So I'm not saying it isn't a difficult decision for athletes and officials and, you know, people who had, you know, for the best of reasons, had their hearts set on the event. That wasn't what I was saying. For me, as making a rational decision, is this worth it? Does it stack up? Well, no, it wasn't a hard decision at all.
So what has been the hardest decision then of your premiership?
Oh, well, there's been a few. So when you say hard, there's different sorts, I think. So there's... It was genuinely you could go one way or the other. So you're sort of balancing up pros and cons. Then there's, so it's difficult to make the decision, to choose which way to go. So that's one set of decisions. Then there's, it's hard because you know the gravity, the impact, how it'll affect people. Mm-hmm. And probably that's where I'd land. I've given a lot of thought to this actually, but I would probably say I won't easily forget... I think it was probably the second. Well, must have been by the tally. It must have been the second last press conference in that epic run of press conferences, 120, when everyone had come to the press conference and there was a real sense of anticipation that the lockdown was going to end. This is the second wave lockdown, the really long lockdown.
Yep.
But we had a bunch of test results that hadn't come back from the lab, and we had a bit of a problem in the inner north, and, you know, there's some schools caught up, and, tests hadn't come back. So we were hopeful that they'd all come back negative, but they hadn't cleared. And for whatever reason, I walk into Treasury Theatre and there's all the journos think it's the day. I think it's the end. We're going to be open up the next day. Yeah. And I couldn't announce that. And the sense of... It wasn't personal. They weren't angry. Well, they were probably, but it was just this sort of sense of despondency, this sense of, oh, God, what do you mean? And then I mustn't have phrased it particularly well, so I had to go back and explain, you know, why we couldn't reopen. In the end, you know, we had put modelling out there, and to the very day we had delivered what we said we would do. Mm. But it was a brutally difficult time, and you knew that the decisions you were making, you know, were having such profound impacts on people, such profound impacts. And people who, through no fault of their own, had built businesses and built livelihoods and, you know, had a sense of, not certainty, but a sense of confidence about the future, and you were just changing all of that. And, you know, it was really hard. It was really hard. But it had to be done. And, you know, you're not there to squib it. You're not there to chase the adoration and love of everybody. That's not the job. Like, I've given this a bit of thought. Like, if you'd been kind of, to your point about getting carried away with yourself, if you had this kind of I need everyone to love me complex through those couple of years, like, who knows where we would have finished up. Mm. Like, I simply won't make any decisions that people won't completely adore. Can you imagine where we'd, like, that would have been just horrendous. It was bad enough doing the right thing. If you'd been trying to turn it to your political advantage, or if you weren't a big enough person to know that with leadership comes an incredible responsibility to do what's right and what's evidence-based and all of that. You know, if you'd been weak enough to suspend that, as opposed to what we did, which was to suspend politics, I don't know where we would have finished up. It would have been just like it was bad enough, let alone if you tried to be popular throughout it. So that's probably the hardest decision. That it seems a small thing, one more day when everyone had waited that long, but there was a sense of expectation. I think people had reached their limit, you know. It was,
yeah.
But no, we had to wait because the lab hadn't processed the results.
I remember it vividly. I think a lot of Victorians do.
It was a nasty presser. It was not good.
Let's talk about the media. You just mentioned the media before. And here's another quote from another former staffer in terms of political communication. They say, Daniel is the best political communicator I've seen in Australian politics. In his time as Premier, I genuinely don't recall him ever saying something that couldn't be called a gaffe. We would discuss potential lines on various issues of the day, and annoyingly, his were always better than mine.
Oh, that's very kind from someone. I wonder who that is.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just want to get a sense from you about your relationship with the media, because they're important in a democracy. Of course they are.
They're a very important job to do. I wouldn't want to do that job.
But it was very adversarial at times, though, wasn't it?
Well, and I don't have a problem with that. Like those 120 press conferences, they got pretty, you know, willing, as they should. Like we were making extraordinary decisions in their scope, in their impact, in their import, and indeed in their cost, human, monetary. Like, it was an unprecedented time. And you should be held to account. Why are you doing this? Please explain why you're doing this. You take us through it all. That's all fine. And if things are not done perfectly, and some things weren't done perfectly, far, far from it. That's the nature. There's no manual. There's no how-to. You know, then you should be scrutinised. That's never bothered me. Never. What bothers me, I wouldn't want to appear bothered. I'm not. But what concerns me is when you've got people who are just absolute pretenders. You're not a reporter. You're not a journalist. You're a partisan. You are not reporting the contest. You are trying to determine who wins the contest. And it might be why, you know, some in the Fourth Estate who have never had a good word to say about me, but more importantly, because it's not about personalities, more importantly, They've never had a good word to say about our side of politics, and yet we keep on winning. We keep on earning the support of the Victorian community. Now, that's not to say that's not every journalist, no. I've never been one to pick up the phone and be, you know, having a crack at editors or reporters. I don't think I've had a crossword with a journalist, really, like apart from, you know, back and forth during presses. That was not my style.
Is that why you never went on Neil Mitchell?
Oh, no, there's a few other reasons for that. There's a few other reasons for that. And to be honest, you know, I'm not interested in fueling that any further.
Fair enough.
And whatever I say will be the feature of some editorial. You know, I will say this, though. Like, I sent him a message when he announced that he was going, and I meant it. All the best to you and your family. And he sent one back. That's not. And then when I retired, he sent me a message. And it was all the best. And then the next morning he's on, you know, on radio that I'm the most corrupt, awful, terrible person in the history of the world. Like, I don't operate like that. So I'm not here to bag him or his program or really to discuss why I didn't go on his program. I had good reasons, and I'm just not interested in continuing that.
More broadly speaking, like, I think you and I were talking about this a while ago, that those of that are old enough to remember the 80s and 90s and the media influence in those days could make or break a government. And I think it's fair to say that your government's media strategy spent less time buttering up to editors and to your own remarks as before for favourable reporting, and used more time using the resources at your disposal on social media platforms is one of them to communicate directly to voters and winning 3 elections in the process. Do you think that the way that this government has kind of redefined political communication, and in doing so has kind of threatened the very, very existence of it, but they've become less influential and less relevant, and that's kind of is what is breaking their brains right now?
No, I don't see it that way. The way I see it is some have inserted themselves into the contest so obviously, so ham-fistedly, that people don't listen to them anymore. They don't trust them. They don't have a sense that they are anything other than biased. I didn't do that to them. Like, I didn't force that. I didn't create that. They're decisions that they've made. And they've all got a job to do, so do it. Like, you want to run around, you know, banging on about the primacy of your role in our democracy, well, then fulfil it. And that doesn't involve editorial after editorial after editorial. Not a frequent Sky News watcher, but I can remember the election night, last one, turn it on. They started their coverage half an hour early. So I turned it on. And, it's going to be very close. Matthew Guy's run a great campaign. Oh, he's really had his best. Oh, he's been in great form, great policy, done a great job. Oh, this is going to be really close. By 8:30, they've got to stop copying Labor. It was a shambolic campaign. Awful, terrible, you know, it's crisis, existential. You know, and Peter Crevlin does her usual thing. She does about 8:30 every election night. They've got to reconnect with conservative voters. Mm. You know, go further to the right. You know, that'll work. So you kind of can't have it both ways. So, you know, so biased as to be, well, obvious. It's not that you're any good. It's that your opponents are awful. Yet you talk them up when it suits you. In any event, this is all noise. And real people who are concerned about their family and their kids' school and healthcare and their job and their future, they can see past that. But we haven't done this to them. Like, they've done this to themselves by all too often. And again, not all of them, but have done it all too often, not even pretending to kind of cover it straight.
Can we clear up one thing that's happening at the moment? Because you're not even in public life anymore, but the Herald Sun keep on writing about you.
I must help to sell newspapers.
Well, are you getting a cut? That's the
No, I'm not. Most definitely not.
Well, you should.
Most definitely not. must be clickbait or sales or something. I don't know, whatever. Look, my view on this is I've always had a pretty sanguine view on this. While they're picking on me, they're leaving some poor other bastard alone. And that's fine. That's fine. You just have to laugh. If you don't laugh, you'll cry.
Do you want or have you sought membership of the Portsea Golf Club?
No. And we'll wait and see what happens. I don't have any difficulty in finding places to play golf.
That is an odd...
Here and in other parts of the world. That's anyway.
That is an odd one. That would be like for me...
That's quite ridiculous.
If I had started a campaign to say that I don't want King Charles to become a member of the Celtic Football Club. Well, I don't think King Charles actually wants to be a member of the Celtic Football Club, but I'm going to run a campaign on it for the next 6 weeks. And I want the Herald Sun to write about it.
And I, you know, somebody posed a question to one of the most vocal opponents of that possible theoretical membership. Well, you wouldn't have to play golf with him. Yes, but I might see him in the bar. I'm like, well, yeah. Well, you might see me at a restaurant anywhere in Melbourne. Like, what are you talking about?
Which was put to him.
Like, what are you talking about?
I asked you before about what have been the hardest decisions you've had to make on the job, but I'm interested to know what were some of the proudest days on the job.
For me, almost always it's stuff that people wouldn't necessarily know about, both highlights as well as lowlights. Like, you know, when you've got to ring people at the worst moment in their life and try and be some small comfort to them, it's not a pro forma thing. It's you try and genuinely commit yourself to do that properly. You try and stay in touch with people. You try and, you know, play that role. The other thing too is from a sort of personal satisfaction or, you know, I'm really proud of that. A lot of the stuff, it's not front page news. It's small things, little things. People who will approach you in the street or ring you up or, I've got a problem. Can you help me with this? And, you know, for a friend or a neighbour or whoever it might be, you know, when you can have an impact, when you can fix things or clear the way for someone to go and do great stuff, yeah, that's what's special. But, you know, you can only be proud, not of yourself, but proud of the people who build things when you go and tour. When you're part of a project from when it's a pile of dirt all the way through to something that's just spectacular. Mm. Like your sense of pride for and in the people who have actually built it. It's a special thing.
Today,
so you don't run for thank yous. Like the best way people say thank you or validate you or kind of you know, fulfill whatever need you have is to say, well, you can keep doing that job. Mm. As difficult as it is, you can keep on doing it. Here's another 4 years. That's what it's about.
Speaking of elections, nice segue there for me, Daniel, thank you. On this day 5 years ago, the people of Victoria handed you a stonking 22-seat majority at the 2018 election.
Yeah, 5 years ago today?
Yeah.
Goodness me.
And
what happened? Oh, yeah, well, yes, that was, yeah. one or two things happened between then and now.
They have.
Another election, pandemic, very, very bad fires, floods, multiple floods. Yeah.
What's been the most, for the campaign nerds listening, what's been your most memorable election campaign?
Oh, the one that you get elected in, the first one, 2002, that was a pretty special thing. Because I've been on the edge of and been... played a part in getting other people elected, but to get yourself elected, that's no small thing. Mm-hmm. We won a lot of seats that election. That was a pretty big result, that one.
That was a big one.
That was a big one. And I had a role, a part to play in that. I've been blessed. I've been around a lot of great campaigns, not always with my name on the ballot paper, though. Like Frankston East, the supplementary election, which got us the seat to then add the three independents in that, which created the Bracks government. That
was in 1999,
that was pretty special. That was very special, actually. And we won well. Burwood by-election when former Premier Kennett left. We won that well too, which was good. I was pretty happy to be the campaign manager there. Benalla, I was not the campaign manager. I sort of had responsibility in a broader sense, but we won that as well when the former Deputy Premier left. So they were all really good campaigns. Worst campaign, I reckon, was the federal election, the Tampa election.
Is that 01?
That's 01, isn't it? Yeah. When we, polling, we were going to win like 7, 8, 9 federal seats. That was a whitewash. It was like Flinders, Deakin, Aston, everything, Ballarat, everything. We finished up, we won, well, McEwen, we, McMillan, everything, right? We were winning everything. And we won one. We won Ballarat. That was it. So I've had like lots of good campaigns and lots of challenging ones as well. More good than bad.
What makes it a good campaign?
Well, if you win.
Yeah.
That's the first issue.
Obviously.
Secondly, if you've got a clear strategy, and if at the end of it you can say, you know, as 6 o'clock approaches on polling day, couldn't have done any more. We've done everything. It's either there or it's not. That's rare. Not everyone gets to be able to say that. But I've been blessed. Great teams of people, great workers, great strategists, you know, and a lot, and just an army of people, you know, thousands and thousands of people who work their guts out again and again and again. And I'm deeply grateful to them.
This is from another staff member. DA was good to work for because he hired good chiefs and deputies. In honesty, I didn't have a huge amount to do with him directly, but because we worked with a great team that everyone was trusted and you're expected to do a good job, and that hasn't been my experience in other offices. And it made our team a killer office that it was. The trust that flowed from him to the leadership team right all the way through to the rest of our team was the key to everything working really well. How important is having good staff in the work that you do?
It's absolutely essential. You know, all this nonsense, you know, centralisation of power and, you know, control freakness and all this sort of stuff. This is just all bullshit, right? The Premier's office has got to be across everything and has got to work really hard and has got to help the whole team function as well as they possibly can. That's not, like, the Premier can't do all of that. The Premier's office has to do that, together with the Treasurer's office and every other office. Like, you know, there's not been a successful government ever that didn't have that sort of central focus about strategy, about that, back to our earlier points about where we want to be in 4 years. Like, you have to have that. Otherwise, you just become listless. You're just adrift. You're just, you know, a thousand flowers bloom. Everyone's doing their own thing. Can you imagine? That's like the orchestra not only without a conductor, but without music. It's just noise. It's just noise. Everyone looks nice. Mm. Everyone's got their, you know, white tie and tails. Everyone's looking great. And it sounds like shit because there's no coordination. So, you know, anyway, I've been blessed with great staff, as JA is. Oh, it's a great team of people. And they work incredibly hard you know, they're not often singled out. They're not often thanked appropriately for the work that they do. But they are incredibly important, just like public servants as well. But no, there is another way to do it, and that's to not have that kind of central clarity and strategy. And if the Premier's office hasn't got that, then the government won't have that, and you won't be the government for long. And for however long you are the government, you won't be very good. Mm. So people have views on these things. It's fine.
What's next for Citizen Andrews?
Oh, I haven't said yes to anything yet. A few different interesting things, but I haven't said yes to anything yet. So I'll spend the summer doing not very much. And I'm working my way through all those books I have bought but haven't read. I've still got a long way to go, but I've made a dent. Playing a bit of golf. Bit of time with the family. It's nice. It's good. I have to sort of recalibrate, reset.
Well, you didn't want to mention your legacy yourself, and you said others can do that. So I'm not going to be able to summarise the legacy of the Andrews government here on this podcast, but if we think back and reflect on what has been achieved, I just sort of did some numbers before the show. 690,000 new jobs were created in the multiple terms of your government, including more than 175,000 jobs in regional Victoria. Well on the way to removing 110 level crossings across Melbourne, free TAFE, billions of dollars of taxpayers' money spent on health and education. You're the Labor Party's longest-serving Victorian Premier. You've seen off 6 Prime Ministers in that time. As leader of the party, you've won 3 elections, undefeated at the ballot box, all whilst maintaining a single-digit golf handicap. Citizen Dan Andrews, thank you for your service.
No, that's very kind. Again, there'd be others would have a different list, but that's fine. It's the nature of things. At the end of the day, it's not you don't get to write your own epitaph, and we're a long way from that anyway. But like, I think the thing that singles this period, not me, this period of time, is that we didn't waste a day. Like, we got shit done. We got things built, and we did what had to be done. We didn't do popular stuff. We lived our values. Our politics is not about us. It's about the people we serve. And you don't serve people well if you just want to be loved and you just want to be popular. Like, being respected is much more important. And I'm very grateful. It's the greatest honour of my life. And to be chosen three times in absolutely emphatic terms. Not just the winning, it's what you do with it. It's then putting those majorities to work for the Victorian people and changing the place and setting us up for the future. It's a great honour, great privilege. And we're in very, very capable hands. Jacinta is doing a fantastic job, settled in beautifully. And she's been there as a minister building that infrastructure and, you know, very senior member of the team, great local member, an authentic person. She's a genuine person. She's a dear friend and someone who's leading the state well and will continue to.
Daniel, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Hey there. Thanks for listening to Social Democratic. Did you like the podcast? Hit the follow or subscribe button and be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. And to get all the latest updates on Socially Democratic, follow Dun Street on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and LinkedIn. And we'll see you next Friday. Socially Democratic was brought to you by Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. Maurice Blackburn Lawyers have spent more than a century paving the hard path to justice for everyday Australians. They've helped over 500,000 Australians turn their situation around, and they know how the system works. Their experience and skills means you'll get the best results possible. Find out more on their website, mauriceblackburn.com.au. Maurice Blackburn, experience you can count on. Social Democratic was brought to you by SwiftFox. Every moment on a campaign matters. You need the tools that you can trust, lists that are up to date, phone banks that can change minds, emails that drive donations, events that will energise the community online and offline, and text blasts that distill your message perfectly. SwiftFox CRM is made for campaigners by campaigners. To find out more, go to swiftfoxcrm.com to win your next campaign.